Hi, everybody. My name is Hal, and I'm an alcoholic. By the grace of God and the fellowship and the 12-step program, Alcoholics Anonymous, I haven't had found it necessary to take a drink since the 28th of February, 1970. And for that, I'm deeply grateful. I hope everybody took notes of what Bud instructed you all on, because he's going to ask questions afterwards in case you didn't know. I sat there, and I hope that guy that got those lights on gets out there. It's really a pleasure to be here in Roanoke. It really was. And I hope and I know that we're all going to remember Bud in our prayers tonight. And I know he would want us to enjoy ourselves and enjoy this wonderful convention. I'd like to thank the committee and Bud and Barry and Harry and Sherry who picked me up at the airport tonight. I've just enjoyed myself since I've been here. And Sherry was a little worried coming down here and wanted to know if everything would go right. And I told an Alcoholics Anonymous, it's my experience that you can't do it wrong. There's just no way you can do it wrong. Somehow we get together and no matter how we try, and we try very hard, we cannot mess it up. It comes out right, exactly the way it was supposed to. And it's going to happen that way here tonight. I feel like Barry, I need to tell a joke. I've been busting with it. A guy told me this joke, and if I don't tell it, I don't know what I'm going to do. It doesn't go with anything. It doesn't mean anything. It just seems so, it tickled me so much, he told me up in Pennsylvania, I just had to wait to tell somebody. It was these three rabbits, and their names were Foot, Foot Foot, and Foot Foot Foot. And these rabbits was always drinking and fighting and going on. And Foot Foot would go to Foot 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 and complain that Foot was stealing his booze and just creating all kinds of trouble. And Foot 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 would tell Foot Foot, don't involve me with that because I don't want to be involved with that mess. You go straighten it out with Foot. Well, one day, Foot died. And they gave him a good funeral, but you know, you got to get drunk to go to a funeral. And after the funeral, they was sitting along the fence. You know how drunk rabbits look. And Foot Foot said to Foot Foot Foot, I guess it's time we went to AA because we got one foot in the grave. I had to tell that. I can't imagine being in a place other than in Alcoholics Anonymous where you could tell that and get away. And I don't know why I even laughed at it, but I laughed all the way down here with me. I remember when I first came to AA, my sponsor told me a story about how you could tell an alcoholic. He said, an alcoholic is the guy who will walk past a saloon and there'd be a sign in the window that said, all you could drink for a dollar. The alcoholic would walk in, walk right up to the bartender and say, give me $2 worth. Now, when he told me that, I didn't find anything wrong with it. That seemed perfectly reasonable to me. I wasn't sure where my head was about then. It was out in Ethiopia somewhere, but to me, drinking was a normal, natural way of life. I grew up in the Spanish Harlem. It's a section of Manhattan, sort of between. It's like a no man's land between the upper Manhattan and the South Bronx. And in that neighborhood, you grow up very quickly, or you stand a very good chance of not growing up at all. When I was a little kid, they used to have trolley cars that ran around the streets for transportation, and you could hitch the back of the trolley car and get a ride. And all the other kids would jump on the back of the trolley car, and I'd jump on the front. Now, that should have told me something. Should have told me something right away. In my neighborhood, the only thing that we understood and really respected was what you had in your pocket. We weren't really thieves. We just found stuff before it officially got lost. if you wanted it, put a padlock on it. And if it was too big to carry, we lay down next to it and claim it. So when I grew up in Spanish Harlem, I didn't have a lot of the things that we learn here in Alcoholics Anonymous. I didn't know things like honesty and integrity and commitment. Those words were alien words to me. I just didn't understand them. The only thing we respected was what we had in our pocket, and that's the way it was. And for many, many years, getting over one day at a time was a normal way of life for me. I didn't learn anything when I came here. One day at a time was a normal way for me to do things. And that's the way I live my life. All along the time, from the time I was a little kid, I used to have to be in charge, and I realized that today. I was a master manipulator. By today's standards, they would call me an entrepreneur. In those days, I was a hustler. But I always got people to do things for me, lots of times when they didn't really want to do it. Most of the kids were learning how to run, and I learned how to box. And I was big, and I was strong, and I was quick with my hands, and I learned how to fight. And that got me over a long time. I was boxing for a long time, and people had generally left me alone. So that I went through my early life doing what I wanted to do, pretty much what I wanted to do, and didn't really care about it. Along around 1950, 51, the Korean War broke out. I was still going to high school. And I did not want to get drafted. I knew if I came out of high school, they was going to draft me. So in my cunning alcoholic mind, I figured that the way to beat the draft would be to join the National Guard. Then they can't draft me. So that's what I did. I joined the National Guard. And the minute I got out of high school, the National Guard unit I joined got federalized. And I wound up on active duty. Well, I joined one of the oldest organizations in the United States, one of the oldest black army organizations in the United States, the old 369th group. The 369th rode up San Juan Hill with Teddy Roosevelt back in the Spanish-American War. And when I joined that group, I met guys that had been drinking since they rode up the hill with Teddy Roosevelt. Now, I had come out of the streets of Harlem, and I had been drinking all my life from the time I was a little kid. And I was going to show these old-timers how to drink. And I guess if my drinking never took off, that was where it was. That was where it began, with the old 369. I had gone to a technical high school, and I had a good background in physics and math and that kind of thing. So they sent me down to a school down in Fort Bliss, Texas. And I got down to Fort Bliss. And it was a strange kind of place because it was right on the border of Juarez. I don't know if anybody's ever been down that part of the country, but in those days you could walk across the bridge from Texas into Juarez. And they used to have a drink. It was called Oso Negro Gin, Black Bear Gin. It cost 44 cents a quart. And I will never forget the first time I drank some of that stuff. A buddy and I were wandering down the street in Juarez, breaking these bottles on the lamppost. Now, the Mexican police will take a very dim view of that. And we wound up in a Mexican jail. And when I was a kid, we used to see Spanish dungeons with the chains on the walls and the hanging circles where they strung you up by your feet, except I used to think that was make-believe until I got into a Mexican jail. And I found out it was real. Now, I've been in jails all over the United States, And I can't remember anything like that. I once got asked to leave jail. Fact. They once asked me to leave. It was a little town upstate New York, and you're not supposed to drink in the street. And I was sitting on the curb sucking out of this wine bottle. Cops came up and said, "Get in." And I got in. And they drove me to their jail, brand new jail. Put me in a cell. And I laid down, lit a cigarette, and fell asleep, and the mattress caught on fire. They took me out of that cell, put me in the cell next to it, laid down, lit a cigarette, and did exactly the same thing. The guy came in and said, "I'm sorry, you have to leave. We don't have any more cells." And they let me out. Now, you know, normal people would think there was something wrong with that. You know, they would think that that's kind of strange behavior. It never occurred to me there was anything wrong with that. And I think that's probably the tragedy of the alcoholic. Because we never see ourselves the way we really are. Other people see it clearly. They can look at us and they can tell that there's something wrong with us. I would be sitting in a bar. And I'd look in the mirror and I'd see this suave, debonair guy looking back at me, and my fly'd be open. I could never see that. Now, other people would see that very clearly, and I think that's the tragedy of the alcoholic. We just go on and on and on and never really have an opportunity to see ourselves the way we are. And so that's what I did. I just continued on. I left Texas, and I came back to New York for a while, and we got discharged, and I went to work for the Army. Never been the same. I went to work for the Army, and because I had been down in Texas, and I had gone to school, and I learned about missiles, you know, I'm probably one of the very few people in the United States that knows how to arm a hydrogen warhead for a barometric fuse for a hydrogen warhead. And I often would think at night, what would happen if I was sitting at that console one day and forgot where I was, and then I was turning on the radio or something. But in any event, I went to work for the Army, and they sent me down to another alcoholic paradise. And this was down in Redstone Arsenal, Huntsville, Alabama. And Huntsville is a dry county, except I had an apartment right next door to a dentist who had his own still. He had his own still. And only an alcoholic could do that. Of all the people in the state of Alabama, I'd get an apartment next door to a dentist that had a still. And he wouldn't sell that stuff. We drank it ourselves. Well, I was going to school. They had sent me down to this guided missile school down in Redstone. And I used to go back and forth on the post, traveling back and forth. There used to be what was known as a Poor Richard's Wednesday, where you could go out on the post and you could get a steak dinner for $1.25 and a shot of booze, I think, was about a quarter. And I remember going out to the post this Wednesday night, and I got pretty well fired up. And I was heading back into town, back to my apartment in town. And for some reason, my alcohol said to go back out on the post. So you're not supposed to make U-turns out on those back roads and I did all the alcoholic things. I checked the back of the car, looked all around. I made this what I considered a fantastic U-turn. And I thought about this for years afterwards, and as near as I can figure out, they had to be in the trunk of my car. The minute I made that turn, there they were, 2 6-foot-6 Alabama state troopers. You talk about the insanity of alcoholism. It is not a good idea to argue with state troopers under the best of circumstances. But for me to argue with them in Alabama is insane. Absolutely insane. And the incredible thing about it is I got away with it. I got out of it. You, if you enjoyed this talk tonight, you should have heard what I told them state troopers. They said, get this one out of here. Let him go. And I got out of that. And there's another tragedy of the alcoholic. We seem to be able to get into the damnedest things and somehow manage to get out. And that's what would happen to me. I would get out of it. Something would happen and I would get out of it. And then I think down the road, well, maybe it wasn't that bad, or it was just dumb luck, or if I hadn't done something, this wouldn't have happened. Never occurring to me, the alcohol was the cause of the bizarre behavior that I was going through. And so I just continued on, doing those kinds of things, getting into the kinds of situations, never looking at myself, never stopping to see who I was, or where I was, or what I was trying to do, or where I was headed with my life. When I came after Huntsville, I came back to the South Bronx, and I did another typically alcoholic thing. I got married. Now, the only reason I got married was because my brother got married. Now, the gang was breaking up around the streets, and everybody was going off getting married and doing their things. We had a unique way of proposing when the girl, when we decided to get married, and the girl would say, that we would say to the girl, "You're what?" Everybody was getting married in my neighborhood. So I got married after she said, "You're what?" And it as it would turn out, I married a beautiful person, and she became my greatest enabler. And we settled down and began to raise a family. And things would go along fine, except that I really didn't want to be married. I really wanted to be back out in the street with the boys. I still had that mentality that said, you can go where you want to, do what you want to, you don't have any responsibility. But I really did. I had responsibilities. And by this time, I had two lovely children. And my wife was trying to provide as good a home as she could. And I had a good job. By now, I had left the Department of the Army, and I had gone to work in the New York City court system. I had spent a little time on New York City police force, and I was lucky I got out of there just in time, and I went to work in the court. And the courts was a very good place to work for an alcoholic. I used to work with a judge that had his own scotch imported here from Scotland with his name on it. And a typical day in my courtroom when I was working would be, I would bring the judge out on the bench, and we would have a first call, and then we take a recess, and we go back in his chambers and knock back a few, and we come back out on the bench and have the second call, and we go back in his office and knock back a few more, and then we come back out on the bench and go to lunch. Now, all the time, the prisoners are still downstairs in the pen. We come back upstairs, come back from lunch about 4 or 5 o'clock in the afternoon and send them back out to the penitentiary. And people used to always wonder why nobody ever got sentenced in our court. But those were the kinds of things that would happen to me. Now, I'm trying to maintain this facade. I mean, I'm trying to be this impeccable pillar of society, and I want to project this image of a good, stable home life. And at the same time, I'm dying inside. By now, I'd have to have a drink before I could even go into the office. And pretty soon, the drink became a bottle in my desk drawer. And after a while, the bottle came right up on the desk, and I started to drink pretty much around the clock. And things at home, as you can imagine, were not going well. I owed everybody. I remember once I was going to go to the bank and I was going to get one loan and pay off all the other loans. And they actually gave me the money. Naturally, I had to stop and discuss the matter with my financial manager, the bartender. And nothing got paid. And it wasn't that I didn't love my family, because I did. I really did. But I couldn't provide the kind of responsibility that I should have, because my mind wasn't there. I didn't realize that during the alcoholic process that my mind had stopped where I was about 5 years old, and it hadn't gone any further. And the responsibility and the commitment that I should have had for my family and the other things that were important in my life, I didn't have, because alcohol had taken that away from me, taken away that sense of responsibility. And so I couldn't do anything. I would come home from work at night, and I would go back into the bedroom, and I would close the door, and I would begin to drink and drink. And my wife would have prepared dinner, and the children would want to talk to me. And I couldn't. And I was afraid to promise my children anything. I couldn't promise Saturday I'll take you to a ball game or I'll take you to the circus, because I knew by Saturday I'd be drunk. And I couldn't do anything, so I never promised them anything. And little by little, this wall began to build up in front of me, higher and higher and higher. And they couldn't get in, and I couldn't get out. And that's the way my life became. The fear began to trap me at every step. I was afraid to answer the phone, afraid to open the door, afraid to go out of the house. The nameless fear that we all know about. It had me in its grip, and I didn't know what to do. I didn't know where to turn. And then the magnificent thought came into my head one day. It's their fault. It's their fault. If I didn't have these to worry about, and I had these bills to pay with, and this job to worry about, I'd be great. So So I walked out. I walked out of a beautiful home with a lovely family, and I wound up in one room. And there it was kind of simple. I still wanted to project this image. I still wanted to be this pillar of society. And I would wander around the streets. By this time I had lost my job and I was unemployable. And I would wander around the streets. And I would panhandle a few dollars. I would wear a shirt and a tie as though I still lived or worked in the court. And I would panhandle enough to buy a bottle, and I go back to my room and drink it and just hibernate. I couldn't see anything. I couldn't do anything. Finally, I couldn't afford the rent on a room, and I wound up out in the street. And then it was fairly simple. It was easy because all I had to do was get drunk one day at a time, find out where the next bottle was going to come from. And that's what I did. I panhandled, and I stole, and I robbed, and I did whatever it took to do to live one day at a time out in the street. And I remember one night I was in a basement, in a dark, dingy basement. And it was a dirt floor, and I'll never forget it because it had an automatic burner. And every time the burner would fire, I would hallucinate and I'd hear Handel's Messiah. I hate to sing today. The whole hallelujah chorus. I remember waking up in that basement, dirty, filthy, hadn't bathed. And I had that moment of clarity that comes to us from time to time where you're not quite drunk and you're not quite sober. And I looked around at myself and I said, what are you doing here? Why are you in this basement? You come from a good family. You have a reasonably good education. What are you doing here? And I couldn't answer it. And so I did what I always did when I got into a jam. I was going to make a deal. I was going to pray to God. You do this for me, I do that for you. Nothing happened. At least I thought nothing happened. I know today that God was with me all the time, that God had never left my side, that from the first day, God was walking in my footsteps right along the way until he led me to the doors of Alcoholics Anonymous. Of course, I didn't know that then. I thought nothing had happened. And so I just came out of that basement and I continued on. And somehow, I don't really know how, I had managed to hang on to my driver's license, and I used to get a job from time to time running dump trucks down in Staten Island and lower end of New York. And I had a job, and I was bringing a truck back to the yard one day, and I had a blackout. And I blacked out at the wheel, and the truck went down an embankment, almost ran out into the kill. And nothing serious really happened, but the police came and they got the truck back up and they suggested that I go and have an x-ray. And so I did. I went down to the hospital, had an x-ray, and forgot all about it. Well, the next morning I was sitting around a table with some colleagues of mine and we had just invested in a bottle. And I get a phone call that says I had to come down to the hospital right away. Well, I had to explain to this lady I had just invested in this bottle, which I was not about to leave. And she said, well, if you don't come down here, we'll send somebody out to get you. Well, I didn't really know what the problem was, but I didn't want to get hassled either. So I decided to go down there. And I don't want to make a long story longer, but it turned out that I had tuberculosis. And I had it so seriously that they would not let me go back. They sent me out to the isolation ward in Seaview Hospital. And I stayed out there for almost a year. And I know today that was God at my side, because it was the best thing that ever happened to me. And it may seem strange saying that you had a serious disease and it was a good thing, but for me it was. Because for the first time in my entire life, I stopped long enough to really look back and check the record. And I saw that every single time that I got into any kind of difficulty, any time that I went to jail or got into a fight or lost a job, or any time anything bad happened to me, I was either drunk, or I had been drinking. And I think it was laying in the hospital in Seaview that the cement block up here lifted and the message went through. that there's something wrong with you. There's something wrong with you, and it has to do with alcohol. God does move in mysterious ways. It's wondrous to behold. And there are no coincidences in AA. It's way, God's way of remaining anonymous. I was on a ward in Seaview Hospital, and I had become very friendly with the supervising nurse. And she had been watching me, never knowing that she was in AA. She had been watching me, and she had me pegged and pinned. And I will remember and never forget the day that I was due to be discharged from the hospital. And I didn't want to leave. I was afraid to leave the hospital because I knew that I was in a controlled environment. And I knew that things were done for me, that I didn't have to do anything for me. And I knew that if I went back out into the street again, I'd be exactly where I was before I got there. And I didn't want that anymore. And I told her, I said, Martha, I can't go back out there again. I'm afraid. And she asked me, and I told her the truth. And she asked me if I really wanted help. And I think for the first instance of God ever operating in my life, I said, yes, I need help, and I really meant it. And it turns out that she arranged for me to go to my first AA meeting, and her husband was there to meet me. And he became my sponsor. And I don't know how it was for you, but I really didn't know what I was walking into when I went into this outfit. I looked around here, and I didn't see no black people at all. I got sober down in Staten Island, and they think the John Birch Society is liberals. I didn't think I belonged here. It didn't look right to me, but I went, and I sat down. And it's hard to explain, but I really don't have to explain to you because you know what I'm talking about. It wasn't so much what they said. It was how I felt. I was at a point where I couldn't really hold a conversation with people. My mind was so mocha that I couldn't talk. I could be talking to a person in the middle of a sentence, I'd forget what I was saying. But somehow it didn't matter. I felt that. I felt that instinctively, sitting in that room with a bunch of strangers that I had never seen before, who I didn't feel any kindred with. All of a sudden, I knew I belonged there. And I knew that it didn't matter what I said. It didn't matter how it came out. Somebody in there would know what I was talking about. Somebody in there would know what I was talking about. And I met my sponsor, Ellie. God bless him. He's sober 27 years. He died 4 years ago. I used to call him my walking stick. He showed me the book of Alcoholics Anonymous, and he said, son, you don't ever have to drink again. He said, every answer you will ever need is in this book. Well, my alcoholic mind got to scheming right away. When I came to Alcoholics Anonymous, everything I owned, I carried around in a shopping bag, and that had a hole in it. And I figured, if everything I ever needed was in this book, maybe I could figure out how to get a loan out of it. So I read that book. I read that book from cover to cover, and I came back and I said, I can't get a loan out of this book. And Ellie just looked at me with his quiet way, and he said, yes, you can. Everything you need is right there. And then we started on that walk that we all know about it, that beautiful walk towards sobriety. And so many things began to happen in my life. I didn't know in the interim, my wife had developed cancer and had died. And my children were in a foster care, and I had to come out of the hospital. I didn't know what to do or where to go. And I used to ride back and forth with Ellie to hospital, back and forth, and I would complain. And he would look at me and just say, give it time. Give it time. No matter what it was, he would say, give it time. I used to say to myself, if he says, give it time one more time, and that's when he'd do it, give it time. And sure enough, little by little, the things would begin to change. I'd go to Ellie and I'd say, I don't feel good. He said, well, this is as good as you may ever feel. I'd say, when am I going to get a job? He said, you had one. He said, I tell him I'm nervous. What am I going to do? He'd say, hang on. And I'd say, how do you hang on? He'd say, let go. Ellie was beautiful. He was a beautiful man. He would say things to me like, "You have a dangerous weapon between your ears." Ellie would take me step by step, and he would always explain to me what we were going to do. And I marvel at the man today and his patience. You know, I sometimes believe they must have a school for sponsors. They must be up in the Bronx. They all say the same thing. I would say, "What am I going to do about this?" He said, "Don't drink and go to meetings." And I asked him about it. He'd say the same thing. "Don't drink and go to meetings." I asked him about it. "But this is important. Don't drink and go to meetings." I think we weren't having a lot of dialogue then. He would let me pick up pigeons and take them to meetings. And he would say, "You pick them up here and you take them over there. Try not to confuse them by talking to them." I'd look back over my life today and I realized that that was a training ground that I would never trade today. I would never, ever trade. See, we would walk through the steps. And he would explain to me. He would explain every single thing that we were going to do. And he would tell me about the steps, the first, second, and third step of the foundation, the cornerstone, and the key to the sunlight of the Spirit, to the arch we're going to build so that we can walk through. And he would say the first step is a cornerstone, the second step is a foundation, the third step is the key. And while he was saying it didn't make a lot of sense until later on, as I looked at it. And he said that what we're going to do is build an arch here. And all the other steps are going to lay against the keystone, which is the third step. And when we're finished, we're going to have an arch that we can walk through into the sunlight of the Spirit. And I didn't really understand that. I didn't really understand any of that. It made no sense to me. But he would say it. And he would make me carry the book, Alcoholics Anonymous, around with me and read it over and over and over again until the light began to come on little by little. Because as I read, he would explain to me and I'd understand what Bill Wilson was trying to do, what he was trying to explain to us in the very simple program of recovery that he's given us. That the secret to every alcoholic problem is not out there, it's in here. It's inside ourselves. Bill Wilson tells us that the great reality is deep down within ourselves. All we have to do is find the means of it. We need to find a power. We are powerless. And we need to find a power. And the power is there. It's out there. If we look and see where we've come from and the things that have happened to us, and when we come to Alcoholics Anonymous, and the things that occur while we're here that we don't really understand or believe very often that are happening to us, we see that the great reality is here. Very often, so many things happen to us that it's impossible to believe that we're going through the change in our life that we're going through and we're going to live a new and better life because it just doesn't seem possible from where we had come from. I remember hearing a story about this little Jewish kid. He came home from the synagogue school, and he went up to his father and he said, "Dad, you should have heard the story the rabbi told us today." He said, "You know, the Jews were trying to get out of Egypt, and the Egyptians were chasing them. Well, when they came to the Red Sea, the Jews had an engineer with them, and they built a bridge over the Red Sea. And when they got over on the other side, the Egyptians were on the bridge. The Jews had a demolition expert with them, and they blew up the bridge with the Egyptians on it." And the father said, "The rabbi told you that?" And the kid said, "No, but if I tell you the story the rabbi told me, you'd think I was nuts." Sometimes we just can't believe the real story. It doesn't make sense to us. And that's what would happen to me. And all this time, as I was going on and trying to see the light and understand the steps and put my life in order, things around me had not gotten better. I didn't know where my children were. When I came out of the hospital, I knew that they were in foster care and I had to track them down. Now, finally, I did, and I prayed. I prayed to God, and I prayed that God would help me find my children. And I don't know about you, but my God has a sense of humor. Ellie used to tell me, "Be careful what you pray for, because you might get it." when God really wants to punish you, he will answer your prayers. So I got back my kids, two teenage boys. And I spent the next 10 years raising them. And that's another story all in itself. And we went through all that trauma and turmoil. And we lived through it with God and AA. And thank God they're both doing well today. But as I was traveling along the steps of Alcoholics Anonymous, I came to point along that I could see that I was changing. I could tell the growth was happening to me. I remember when the first time I looked at the fourth step, and I didn't want to do the fourth step. I don't think there's anybody that walked in their AA meeting and look up on the wall and see those systems, the 89 things they really want to do. I know I didn't. And he said that you have to do a fourth step. If you don't do the fourth step, you can't know who you are. That made so much sense. If you don't know who you are, you can't change. And if you don't change, you're the same person you were when you walked through the door, and that person was a drunk. And I didn't want to be a drunk. So I sat down and I did a fourth step, and I wrote the fourth step, and I realized what they were saying. That the power, the great power that's here is deep down inside me, because as I wrote and as I understood, I began to see the power emerge. But Wilson tells us there are three things that we need to do. We need to rid ourselves of all bias. We need to think honestly and look down inside ourselves diligently, and the power will emerge. I once heard a guy say, nobody can give you power. Power is something that you have to take. And the power is here in Alcoholics Anonymous. All you have to do is reach out and take it. There is but one higher power, one ultimate authority. It doesn't matter what you choose to call them. But that power and that force is here for us if we care to have it. It's one mind, a billion faces, and common love to all men. And that there is reality based on our experience. And if we take the reality and we take our experience and we put that into a form that we can use to change ourselves and find the power that lies within ourselves, that power within us will emerge. And the power that emerges is awesome. It's awesome. If you think about what happens to a person who's an alcoholic and comes to Alcoholics Anonymous, and they walk in and they sit down and they stay and they listen, and then one day a light goes on, and that light begins to grow and grow and grow, and that person becomes a new person, steeped in the spirit, steeped in the understanding that God is the Father of us all. That if we want real power, we have to subject ourselves to his will and his understanding. And that power will come to all of us. So I continued on to my journey, down the steps. And it says, it tells us in our book that if we are painstaking about this phase of our development, we will be amazed before we are halfway through. We will know a new freedom and a new happiness. And that's what happened. A new freedom and a new happiness. The chains came off. My mind began to expand and grow. I began to be able to do things that would never occur to me to do. Intuitively, I understood what I needed to do. And they began to happen for me. And I didn't do anything. I came to you people. That's all I did. I came to you people, and you told me what to do. It's such a phenomenon for people who come to Alcoholics Anonymous that all we have to do is just show up, sit down, and let it happen. And it's all here for us. It's all here for us. I have had the real rare privilege of knowing many of the early members of Alcoholics Anonymous. My sponsor, Ellie, got me involved in service work very, very early on. And it gave me an opportunity to meet some of our early founders of Alcoholics Anonymous. And you know, early on, we didn't have Alcoholics Anonymous. We took our name from a book. We took our name from a book. There wasn't any. As a matter of fact, the name Alcoholics Anonymous was almost a mistake. They got down in Washington and got to arguing about what it ought to be called one day, and they called down to Washington and found out how many books were called Alcoholics Anonymous and how many were called another name, The Way Out, and they found out there were 13 books called The Way Out, so we got to be Alcoholics Anonymous almost by default. But when you think about it, it's beautiful. It's beautiful because we are a fellowship of the book. We are a fellowship of the book, Alcoholics Anonymous. And in knowing and meeting with the early timers, we can see how very, very fortunate we are. Our founders were just here. Many of them are just here. We just lost three of our very dear early helpmates in Alcoholics Anonymous. Dr. Milton Maxwell, who was one of our early chairmen, and Dr. Jack Norris, another early chairman and a stalwart of Alcoholics Anonymous, and of course our dear Lois, just passed on. But I knew them. I knew them. I knew them well. I would be in conferences with Dr. Jack, and I would sit and talk to him, and I'd get the benefit of his wisdom. And we all have that because we are so very close to our founders.
This is the end of side one. Please stop your machine now and turn the tape over for side two.
Always. History has not dealt fairly with alcoholics. And if you look back over history, you see that alcoholics were shunted into the background, into the darkness. And there were many well-intentioned people who tried to help us. The Washingtonians were a group that came out to help us, to try to help alcoholics. But because they became involved and embroiled in things other than their primary purpose, they fell apart. And how many people today outside of Alcoholics Anonymous has ever heard of the Washingtonians? The Emanuel group, a good idea, came along shortly after that. They were going to put a marriage together between science and religion. And they were going to save the alcoholic combining these two forces. And there again, they got involved with matters and issues other than the alcoholic, and they fell apart. And then along came the Oxford Movement. And it's very curious about the Oxford Movement, because the Oxford Movement was a third century evangelical movement that was supposed to bring Christian principles to the whole world. And because they got involved with many political and other kinds of issues, their movement collapsed. And how many people know about the Oxford Movement aside from people in Alcoholics Anonymous? But out of the Oxford Movement came AA. All our principles came from the five core absolutes of the Oxford Movement. And it's strange because as the Oxford Movement was designed to carry Christian principles to the whole world, Alcoholics Anonymous is doing just that. We are carrying Christian principles to the whole world. And I believe that Alcoholics Anonymous are a gifted bunch, a gifted few. And I don't mean that in an elitist kind of way. I think that God has always chosen the least of them to show the others the way. And the alcoholic truly is the least of them. And yet, we have that gift. We have that mystical cord that binds us one to another. That everlasting gift that says one alcoholic can save another alcoholic, and nobody else can do that. Nobody else has that gift. So it's important, I think, and the challenge that meets us all as we continue on our journey into sobriety, is to see that all the people who have to come behind us have this message, the same as we got it. To practice these principles and project the principles as they were given to us. To be able to sit down with the gal or the guy that's coming in for the first time and show him the way, show her the way we got it, the way we got the message. If you were to take everybody in this room and you put them into a rocket ship, there's a star out in the universe, Alpha Centaurus, about 600 million miles away. If you were to send that rocket ship out toward that star, and you didn't tell everybody in it who they were and where they had come from, generation after generation after generation, by the time that ship got out to that star, would be just a bunch of people floating out in space, not knowing who they were or where they had come from. So that carrying the message becomes critical to the preservation of Alcoholics Anonymous as well as to our own sobriety. It's imperative that we take the message that's in that book, Alcoholics Anonymous, to pass that through the fabric of our lives and pass it on. Pass it on to the gal and the girl that comes behind us. I have the very rare privilege of serving on the Board of Trustees at the General Service Office. And ever since I've been on the service kind of effort that the General Service Board projects to the Alcoholics Anonymous, the fellowship at large, I realize how important that is, because I travel around a lot and I talk to people. And I talk to people who come to Alcoholics Anonymous who do not have the commitment to Alcoholics Anonymous. And that's all right, so long as we know the commitment is there and that there are people who will help us preserve what we have, so that we don't presume that it will be here, that we ensure that what we do will be carried on and on and on. I had the privilege of speaking at the Bill W. anniversary a while back, and I talked to Lois, his wife. And at the anniversary each year, she reads a message, Bill's last message to AA. And the message, in part, is from some Arabic AA. When Bill went to Saudi Arabia and he met with some Arabian alcoholics. And at the close of the meeting, the Arabs say, we salute you and we thank you for your life. And Lois explained to me that the Arabs were telling Bill that they salute him and respect and revere him because he came and gave them their lives. So that it's in settings like this, where you are carrying the message, where you come together and celebrate our fellowship and project to the world that Alcoholics Anonymous is here for everybody. No matter who you are, where you come from, or what your station in life is, you're here and you're going to continue to be here, and Alcoholics Anonymous will be here because of the people like you here and many, many other places around the world. And I feel very much like Bill did when he was talking to the Arab, very much like Bill did, because I know that it's you that will preserve AA. It is you that will bring the message to the millions of people who still suffer. So what I really mean to do is to salute you, because you have given me my life. Thank you.
This tape was produced by Happy Trudge Audio, Roanoke, Virginia. For a list of other tapes available, please write Happy Trudge Audio, Post Office Box 20615, Roanoke, R-O-A-N-O-K-E, Virginia, 24018-0062. Thank you for your purchase, and we hope you have enjoyed your tape.